All right, welcome back. This is Fiber Talk. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And this week our guest is Orna Willis. Orna, hi.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Welcome.
Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So just some upfront stuff here. Really want to thank everybody. We've had good support and some excitement for our podcast series to the point where Christine and I originally were going to start out and do one every 2 weeks. And now we're working really hard to do a podcast every week because there's been good excitement about it. And then just in this past week, if you're new, we now are available on iTunes. So you can just subscribe to the podcast there and get it automatically downloaded to your phone or whatever it is you listen to podcasts on. And then here in the next few weeks, we'll be adding other podcast services. But iTunes was the first one. We wanted to get that in right away. So we have that. So that's a good thing.
And spread the word.
Yes.
Share yeah, that's with your friends.
Yeah, yeah, spread. We're posting wherever we can so people can learn, but the best way is to tell others. That's most effective. So, yeah, lots of good response, and we have good guests lined up, and really excited to have Orna here for just somebody I followed for a long time. So really excited to talk to her and learn more about what she's doing. So, and then a new segment for us, and that's to start out each show by talking about what we're working on. So,
right.
Christine, you get to go first this time.
Yeah, so very briefly, just whatever project we happen to be working on, which in this case is immediately, like I'm working on it right this second, because I always do this while I'm recording. A friend of mine asked me to knit her.
So listen for clicking of knitting needles. Is that what it is?
Yes. Yes. Exactly. A friend of mine asked me to knit her a hat for the Women's March. Now, she didn't tell me until after the Women's March, and it turns out that a lot of women. Well, so I'm a little late to these parties, right? So a lot of women at the Women's March in Washington D.C. all wore the same pink, like, kitty cat hat, right? So, and they were all knitted and just, you know, completely crowdsourced. Everybody got on board and kind of got the same pattern, which is really super easy and quick to knit up. And so many people were wearing this hat that it actually made a visual presence. So anyway, she asked me to make her one. So that's what I'm working on right now.
That's good. In pink?
Of course, that's the only way to do it.
Okay, I'm just checking. Just checking.
I think that's part of the rules, kind of.
Oh, okay. I didn't know there were rules, but all right.
Well, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Is it a simple pattern?
Very, extremely simple. Anybody. In fact, it would be a great first pattern for somebody to make because it's really just back and forth, knit purl, no increases or decreases. Really, really super easy. So, yeah, very easy to find online. If anybody's looking for them, just look, you know, Google Women's March hat, and you can find it. And then there's hats planned for the Science March, if anybody's interested. And those are, we'll talk about it in a later podcast because those are a little bit more complicated and funnier. So what are you working on, Gary?
I am at the final stage of Debbie Rowley's Diamond Delight 3. And, this is, I don't know, is it a foot by a foot or so, one of Debbie's charts, and I got everything stitched, and I'm down to the beads, and I don't know how many beads I have to put on. There's a bead that goes in every diamond in the corners, and so I got to put those in. So I posted in Needlepoint Nation Sunday that, you know, my work in progress, and said I was down to the beads, and Debbie said that to make sure, because I'm going to make a, Marga's my wife, she wants to make a pillow out of it. And Debbie said, if you're going to do that, make sure those beads are strapped down well, and suggested that I wax the thread and go through the beads twice, which I was going to go through the beads twice, but I had not thought about waxing the thread. But it was interesting because when she said that, I thought, wait a minute. Long ago, I don't know if you guys remember, there was a short craze, at least it was short in my world, of candle wicking, which was like crude embroidery with candle wick, heavy candle wick type stuff. And you had to wax all that to stitch with it. And I did one half a project, and it was just an unpleasant experience to me, so I just never finished it. And but I bought a little holder with beeswax in it. And so I went digging, and sure enough, I still had that. And of course, the beeswax, I mean, it lasts forever. So I still have it. So I didn't have to go out and buy something. So that's the last thing, is to put the beads on Diamond Delight 3. And then I can get on to another Debbie chart. So, yeah, that's where I'm at. Yay. Orna.
Hey, cool. Orna.
So I'm actually working on 40-count silk gauze, and I found a source for the most beautiful exotic feathers. So I had to have some. I bought a few feathers, ordered a few feathers, and I am stitching 3 feathers and actually going to attach a 4th one, which is one of these feathers that I got in the mail. So we'll see what happens with that.
Okay,
that's what I'm working on.
All right, now I got to ask questions about silk gauze, because was Arlene, I think on Needlepoint Nation, Arlene Cohn, I think is her name, just finished the most beautiful 1-over-1 on silk gauze piece that I think I've ever seen. Took her forever. She is gorgeous, and just posted here a week or so ago that she had it framed, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. So what silk gauze looks like, it'd be a challenge. Is it, or is it, once it's on a frame, just pretty much straightforward?
I actually get my silk gauze from Krynek. They mount it on a frame, a piece of heavy cardstock frame. I don't think I'm calling it the right name, but imagine an insert to a frame.
Right, like a mat.
I like a mat. Oh, thank you. That's the word. And it comes already on this mat. And So you tell them what size you want, and they send it all mounted and ready. So that's really helpful, because silk gauze, not like mono canvas, for instance, it's not woven. It's actually... what would I call it? It's like one piece, and rather than, you know, the threads going over and under. Therefore, you can't stretch it like you would regular canvas. So anyway, to make a long story short, you get it already mounted. And I find that if you have good magnifying light, it's just as easy to work with as anything else. The only thing you need to kind of pay attention to is your tension. So you don't want to really pull on the silk. You want to kind of just lay it and let the silk decide at what tension, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because that was my primary question is when you say silk gauze to me, that says delicate. And so I wondered just how much you could pull on threads with that stuff, and not much, huh?
No, you don't want to pull much, but, you know, you get the hang of it really quickly, and it lends itself to such intricacy just because of how small it is. You get to do so much in such a little piece of fabric that it compensates for any tension that you need to pay attention to.
Is this your first time with it?
No, I've done it before, and I actually designed a few pieces on silk gauze. I love working on it. I know it's a little frightening at first, but I find it very, very relaxing, really. You just have to have the right light and the right magnification.
And you're stitching with silk on silk gauze, or what, or does that not matter? Whatever thread you want to use.
I feel that it deserves silk, you know. So yeah, I do. I use nice, beautiful silk. You don't need much. That's the nice thing about it. You get a lot done with just a little bit of thread.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's neat.
It is fun.
All right, going to have to try that. On the list. It goes on the list. Got to try it. let's back up the truck all the way. So I started following your blog a long time ago, and I was telling the story before we started recording. You at one time were selling – I was looking for a box, a wood box, to put an insert in for our daughter-in-law. and ran across, you were selling these beautiful colored lacquer boxes, and that was when I first encountered you, and I flinched at buying one, and then the next time, and I found it was a smaller box I needed, and so I found that elsewhere, and these were much larger than I was looking for. But I added you to my Feedly list so that I was getting your blog posts all along, and then, of course, visiting your websites as I was intrigued. So I've been following you for a long time, and really glad that you joined us this week, because I've always wanted to talk to you about, because the colors you use and the intricate designs you do with your needlepoint designs, and then you branched out so much with your Etsy shop and fobs and all kinds of things that you're making. And so I'm really, really glad you're joining us so mm-hmm. we can explore all those things. So, yeah. But take us back. Let's just go all the way back. When did you start stitching? I mean, were you the standard one where your mother taught you and you just kept doing it, or did you pick it up later?
No, I didn't. I picked it up much later. I had studied and played around with all sorts of different art, but never needlepoint. And much later, 1994, and just to do the math, I was 37, I think, something like that, so much later, I happened to come across it through a friend who did needlepoint and wanted to stop at a shop to pick up some thread that she had run out of.
Uh-oh.
And exactly.
The gateway.
Exactly. And it happened to be the most beautiful shop. It was in Petoskey, Michigan. The shop is no longer around, but we walked into this place that had these beautiful big baskets brimming with threads. They were sort of like spilling over. It was almost like walking into, you know, seeing grapes, like just hanging over these beautiful baskets. And I felt my mouth starting to water. I had never seen threads like this. I'd never done anything like this. But what I immediately thought was, I had studied painting, and I immediately thought of how interesting it would be to paint with the threads. And so I kind of wandered around, and I came across these patterns that Rainbow Gallery, I don't know if they still have them, but they're sort of small designs that you can get. They publish them on one or two pages. They're very inexpensive, and I bought one of them and then, you know, added the threads. And should I continue?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. I love to hear addictions unfold.
As it happens. Exactly, yes. And I mean, if you know my work, color is a huge, huge thing for me. And interestingly enough, I chose a design that asked for all creams. All of the threads were different threads, but all in cream. And I don't know what possessed me, but that's what I picked up. And I took it home and sat up. I'm not kidding. I sat up the whole night just stitching. I didn't know what the stitches were called. I couldn't pronounce the names. The instructions were good, but I kind of had to, you know, come up with some of my own solutions when I didn't understand them. And the next day, it was a small design. The next day I was done. But oh my God, I needed a fix. I needed more. So, yes, that's where it started. Exactly.
Okay, now I'm from Michigan, so how do you end up in Petoskey?
We lived in Michigan in the in the, I lived in Midland, Michigan, and then in the Detroit suburbs. But my friend had a wonderful summer, winter getaway in Petoskey.
Yeah.
And so she invited me to get away, you know, kind of like a girls' weekend. And part of it was running over to get some thread that she needed. And so we both sat up and stitched the night away.
Or in his own personal crack dealer right there. Yeah.
Exactly. No,
I was born in Flint, grew up in Clyle, so I know the area. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, Petoskey's beautiful.
Oh, it is gorgeous
area,
up there.
That
yeah.
whole area.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So that's yep. where it started, but, you know, it certainly traveled from there quite a ways.
So you started stitching. Then did you stitch for a long time before you started designing, or did that artist in you immediately have to take and do something more with the charts or patterns that you were buying?
So yeah, I kind of feel like it was chutzpah. It was like very, very fast and hooded, I think I was, but I stitched probably 3 or 4 designs, and then I started experimenting. And I, you know, would just sit there and come up with strange stitches and strange shapes. And within a few months, I had tons of these little pieces of needlepoint, and had no idea what I was going to do with them. And so I thought, okay, let's come up with some ideas. And that's when I started making, I made ultra suede handbags and used the stitching on the handbags as either the clasp that you need to open, or just kind of embellishing them. And did that for a while, and happened to come across someone who had a gallery, an art gallery in Bay City, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw me with one of my bags and asked if I would do a little show at her gallery.
Mm.
That was embarrassingly a short time after I started stitching. she said, well, would you please? And I said, oh, yes, I would love to, with really not having much to show. So I quickly, you know, got busy on stitching and sewing and so forth. But what I also did was I came up with a design, and I sent it to Rainbow Gallery because I had seen those, you know, the first design I did was theirs, and I thought maybe they'd be interested in having me design something for them. And so this is a really sweet story. I came up with a design, and I called it Jessica's Garden. And the reason that I called it that was because I stitched Jessica's, Jean mm-hmm. Hilton Jessica's on them.
Right, yep.
And it was very lovely and very colorful, and I used all Rainbow Gallery stitches and, I'm sorry, threads. And I packed it up. I was in Michigan, and I sent it off to California, the Los Angeles area. And 2 days later, I got a phone call from Jay from Rainbow Gallery. He was one of the managers there. And he called me and said, oh, we got your design, and thank you. It's great. We think we'd like to purchase it from you. And then he said, but let me tell you how you're supposed to stitch as Jessica. I have never felt two emotions so intensely at the same time. I was so happy and so embarrassed at the same time. And that's when he, over the phone, explained how you're supposed to properly complete a Jessica.
Mm.
So that you you have it continuing in the same way where there's always a stitch over and a stitch under.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't, anyway, you didn't do that last little, what is it, under thing, right?
I didn't know to do the over under. Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly. So I learned that, and I make a point of adding that to my instructions because nobody should be embarrassed like I was ever again. So that was the beginning of my designing, and kind of went from there.
That's pretty neat. So just took a shot. Just took a shot just to see, huh? That's great.
I did, yeah. Yeah.
So how would you describe, if you were describing your designs to someone who hadn't seen them, how would you describe them, and what things make you happy about them? So you said color is one.
Color is huge. I would say that my designs are probably ethnic and contemporary. I grew up in the Middle East, and I have, I guess, that kind of an influence of the, you know, the shapes, the interesting curves. I think a lot of tile work that you would associate with the Middle East, with Morocco, that kind of stuff has influenced my work. So I think you'd see a lot of that, a lot of the color. And I think there's something that when you see a piece, you can kind of say, oh, that might be Orna. But mm-hmm. I also think that I try to do something different every time, mostly so that I don't get bored.
Right.
To put something else every time. Yeah. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, perfectly. Perfectly. And because I asked because one of the things that we talked about actually with Debbie, and we were thinking about, and I've thought about it now with quilting and knitting, for me as a beginning needlepoint person, really, because I haven't done any kind of needlework since I was very small, I would immediately go to choosing a pattern based on the color it was done in. And when we were talking, Gary had said that he was all about texture, and he immediately goes and changes all the colors that something is done in. And so it's interesting that you're saying that for you, it's almost the opposite, that the color is what is driving, and that the texture and the blend of stitches is only supporting the color. Would you say that's accurate?
I think so. I think so. I'm trying to kind of recreate. When I sit down to design, and I design on the canvas, I start just sitting down with a few threads. I never choose everything I'm going to use. I'll choose maybe two or three threads that intrigue me to start with. And then I kind of build from there, but I definitely first choose the colors. Yeah. But I think that the colors, the way they talk, depends on what I do with them. Mm-hmm. So the stitching comes right after that. It's sort of like, you know, a background color would be the stitches.
Right.
So I have my paint. But now I need to put it down with certain brushes and certain strokes. And so that, yeah, I guess I kind of go with both of them.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have a sense that you don't really think about it much. It just happens because you just let it flow out of you.
I do. And I don't mean it to sound, you know, all spiritual or something.
Oh, no. This is what I'm reading in hearing you talk is, because I'm so glad Christine asked that, because, you know, how does it happen? Do you sit down with a pattern or a shape in mind, and it sounds like you just get some thread and start moving it and see what happens?
Mm-hmm. I do, yeah. So it can either be where I've started exploring something and I haven't finished playing around with it. It might be a variation on something that I just designed. Or it might be a sort of, okay, I've done that. I'm going way over to the other side. It might be that I have just completed a very large piece. And so then I'll come and do, you know, 40 count silk gauze, 4x4 kind of size. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I never really know what the end result is. I'm not always sure what the colors will be at the end. It's the beauty of the needlepoint that I do is that I start with an empty canvas and it comes to life right in front of me. It's sort of like a flower opening and you don't really know what the middle is going to look like. You just have to kind of let it open up and then there it is. So that's kind of how I sometimes also like to challenge myself. So when I'm talking about color, there will be times where I will say, all right, you've done, you know that purple and turquoise look really great together, or purple, turquoise, green. Okay, we've done that, said that. What about these two colors that absolutely make you want to puke when you go look at them together? Let's see you make something work here. And that's sort of a challenge. It's like a mystery to me. So, you know, what bridges do I build between these two colors that will make them work so beautifully together? And you know, trying to figure that out. Sometimes I don't, but I try.
I can appreciate that because, as well, Gary and I have known each other for a very long time, and we are very much opposites in many ways. And but in this way, so I often will do exactly that. I'll say, what is the hardest thing I can think of to do? I'm not a gradual starter. I'm going to do this and I'm going to jump in and do the most complicated thing first and figure it out along the way. And I think the key for me is that I'm not afraid to rip out stitches with whatever it is that I'm doing. I mean, half the things that I've done, I've started and ripped out and done three times before I figure it out. But mm-hmm. then you proceed and learn something. So not only do you have the piece at the end, but you feel like you've actually progressed as a stitcher or a knitter or whatever it is that you've done, because you've gained some sort of skill or knowledge. I think technique wise, that's true. For me, I think the gift really comes with color, because that's a difficult thing to teach. You know, either it's one of those things where either you're naturally very good at it, or, you're going to struggle with it a little bit as far as knowing what is going to work with one another, you know, aside from things that are obvious, right? Like you said, some things, you know, working all in purples or working all in creams and just going texture is easy. But then, you know, figuring out how you can blend a purple and a green together and have them work and not look silly, that really does take, I think, innate skill to do. And I'm not sure how to develop that skill other than just, you know, maybe doing it or hanging around smart people that know how to do it.
I think what you said has a lot to do with it. When you talk about starting with the most difficult, I sort of see that as courage, as not being afraid. And I think the same thing goes for color. Trying it, going in directions that you've not seen done before. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you rip it out or you put it aside, or you find that you've solved this mystery, unraveled it, and wow, how wonderful is that? So it's very gratifying.
So I have an image of a drawer full of things that you started and just kind of hit a dead spot and put them away and let them cook a little bit.
It does happen, although I'm kind of stubborn. when things don't really work, I tend to hear myself, oh, really? Well, I'll show you. And I kind of tackle it from the other side. I'll tell you where I have lots of pieces. I have lots of pieces that are done, but have to have someone come and write instructions. That is where my Achilles heel is, writing the instructions.
Yeah. I'm not surprised, because I've gotten that sense just reading blog posts from other designers that that's the drudgery. That's the grind work, is coming up with the instructions.
See, I always think that would be fun. Well, okay, but I have my mind tends to go very logical. So for me, taking something that's already created and breaking it down into words would be fun. I say that now, but, you know, I might not be. I might not have done it enough times, right?
You have to do it, and you have to make sure that you want to do it really well. You don't want someone at home, you know, like calling you all sorts of names. And then you also, I find that by the time the instructions come around, I've already visited this piece as much as I want to.
You're bored.
I want to move on. Yeah, I'm itching to start something new. So that's a bit of a problem, but I try to force myself to do that as well.
So you have a bank of people that stitch your designs once you get all that done to make sure, or how does that work for you?
Yes, I do. I have proof stitchers that have been working with me for, I think maybe 15 years. And then I add new ones, because some of the ones that have been working with me, sometimes they so know what I mean that they don't pay close attention what I've written. But I usually have my pieces stitched at least by two different people. And that way I get, you know, different input. And no matter how many years a design is out, and no matter how many people have stitched it or proof stitched it, I will still go in to teach, and still someone will say, I think there's a mistake here, to which I immediately go, oh no, because it's so hard to keep everything perfect.
Right.
We try, but it doesn't always happen.
Yeah. Well, see, this process intrigues me, because I'm a magazine editor. And so it's the same kind of thing. You have each step is three or four layers of people editing or proofing to get to a final product. And then my wife works with me on the two magazines that I'm editor of. And when she first started some 10 years ago with me, she was just bound and determined that we were going to produce the perfect issue. And I'd been doing it for a long time. I've been doing it for 35 years. So, you know, I've done a few issues. And I said, Margaret, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. You know, it's virtually impossible. There's always going to be a comma missing, or, you know, just something every time. And she was so determined. And I said, you're just going to drive yourself nuts. But you're in your design, you're going through that same process, and your instructions do have to be as perfect as possible, because you're right. You know, somebody sitting at home on a Sunday night getting frustrated with your chart is not what you want. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that even down the road, you encounter from time to time an error, and then it sounds like that error may have been there all along, but everybody's just figured it out or stitched over it or sorted it out and said,
exactly.
Oh, she really meant this. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's so true. You know, let me tell you, this probably won't sound so nice, but I'll tell you anyway. One time I discovered what is the recipe for the best proof stitcher ever. And the recipe is to find a really, really mean person, because they so want to find a mistake.
Yeah,
it's just bringing them pleasure, and they will. I've had that one time with someone that was absolutely phenomenal. But then it sort of became unpleasant after a while.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Moved on.
Yeah, that little monster can get right. Yeah, that can be a problem after a while. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have to ask a question. So, and again, so Gary and I have very different areas of expertise, and from the design perspective, I certainly don't know anything at all. So this is going to be a very beginner-y question. I'm very intrigued as we're talking by the idea of reverse engineering a piece. So, and what I mean by that is, no, you've stitched the piece and now you're going to write the instructions for the piece, but you've done it. So you pretty much know how to do it and you've got it in your head. How does it ever happen that the person who does the stitching provides that to someone else who would then look at it and chart it for them? So in other words, just reverse engineer it, because to that person, it's brand new. Right. And I wonder if that ever happens, if that's ever done that way.
It is. I know that there are, I know of a few stitchers that's their expertise. They do wonderful instruction writing. Mm-hmm. In order to write the instructions, you also have to know how to use the charting software.
Right.
So it does, beyond just writing the instructions, it does demand some other skills. And there definitely are people that do that very well. I guess in part it's a matter of, it's a matter of cost in part. Mm-hmm. And it's, also, there aren't that many people that I know that do that, and some of them are extremely busy. So, it could be a problem, but I wish there were more. It would be great if I could, just do the part that I like.
Yeah.
Although, I also enjoy the charting, because I do chart, I try to chart things that are aesthetically pleasing, so I chart with color. And try to do, a lot of illustrations and photography to help along the way. So it's not that it's all bad. It's just that it's very time consuming, and mm-hmm. it's hard to do that and the stitching and the designing and all that. It's a struggle, going back and forth.
And see, it's interesting. It's interesting to me, because with any hobby, about the quickest way to ruin it is to make a business out of it. Because, it happens all the time. It happened to me with photography, and for many years I didn't shoot because I started doing weddings to make money on the side. And then pretty soon I wouldn't even pick up the camera during the week. It was just Saturdays only, and I'm sick of it. And, mm-hmm. and so many people will start a business and with their hobby, and then they find that the business is so much that they don't get to do the hobby anymore. And at least with your design approach, you're getting to do the stitching, because that's what you start with your designs. So you get to do the stitching, but then do you get like your silk gauze thing? I mean, that fun stuff to do that's just the pure hobby. Is that what's, has that happened to you that you lose that time?
Not in the stitching. I see what you're saying. Yes, I don't have as much time to stitch, but I'll tell you that I really like stitching in the evening when the day is sort of coming to an end. And it's a time where I wouldn't be doing anything else anyway. So that's mm-hmm. kind of my time. And it kind of stays that way as a fun thing and as my treat at the end of the day. So that's good. I can say that there's a lot of aspects of the business that take up a lot of time. And, most of them I enjoy, because most of them have to do with being in contact with the people that stitch my designs, my customers. I love that part of it. So it doesn't bother me. And there's a lot of great stuff that goes along with working at home, in your own environment, in your studio, that is really nice. It's enabled me to be with my daughter a lot and, you know, be able to kind of decide on what to do, when to do, how to do it on my own. So I guess there's a plus and minus in everything, but all in all, it's been a good journey.
Well, and of course, as a mom, to be home as your kid's growing up and be able to be there all the time, that's, you know, that's a really a blessing. You know, so many mothers don't even have that option. So, you know, that's just, that's something that was always, we were able to do is have Margaret home with our kids. And she'll mention from time to time how, you know, that was worth, it was worth everything because, she was home at, in that, watched them grow up, experience the things. And, yeah, that's, mm-hmm. That's a real plus. Yeah. So, okay. Studio. What do you have? You just a corner in the basement? You have a full blown room? What does someone like you that does all that you do get, you know, what's your work environment?
Yes, I do have a full blown room. I spend a lot of time thinking about making my environment very aesthetically pleasing. I like to work in an area that is, to me, beautiful. So I have my threads hanging on the walls of the studio. I try to keep everything in nice containers that are nice to look at. I have everything very accessible. I just like the environment and the workplace to be a fun place to be in. And so, yeah, I kind of spoil myself in that. Like, my best friend is the Container Store where I can buy all these fun things to display. I think it's also really nice to be able to see your material. And that's,
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's like looking at all your yarn and getting inspired by it. Yeah, I tend to make sure that where I'm working is beautiful to me. Yeah.
So lots of daylight, windows, daylight, big table.
Yes. Big table. I have a lot of, I have a lot of IKEA kitchen furniture. So, you know, it's these islands that they have with lots of drawers. Where I can set everything out, lots of nice cabinets with nice drawers that pull out and have things all lined up and color coordinated and, yeah, all of that stuff.
What is it with IKEA? Because that's what I ended up when I got a chance to build my little stitching corner is Marga and I went to IKEA. And I had in mind something, and she found the excellent solution. And they just really seem to have a knack for designing the things that, it, like kitchen stuff that works for stitching. You know, that's great.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I think you just have to go in with an open mind. But they're just geniuses. They're brilliant, and they're reasonably priced.
Right.
Yep. Which helps too. Designed two laboratories out of IKEA furniture, so you can't knock it.
Yeah,
that's right. I think that once you put the things together, you might not want to take them apart and put them together again. That might be a bit of a problem. I don't know how well they you can rework them, but yeah, they're really good for that first time.
Yeah. So threads everywhere in your studio, and that leads me to, because one of the things that I don't even want to admit how many hours I've gone through your site looking at the bundles of threads that you put together, the different color groupings and different types of threads, And my friend Mary, one of my favorite things when she first saw where I work, you don't have enough stuff. And, and so I'm taking that as license to get more stuff. But but it's just so much fun when you put those bundles together of different colors at different times of the year. And and of course that leads to your Etsy shop and your overall greater business. What gets you doing that and you know, just bundling up threads, because you really do a tremendous job of it. It's you know, drool over Orna's threads type thing.
Thank you. You know, two things. First of all, I love doing it. The actual putting together and coming up with these combinations, I love doing that. But everything else that I offer in addition to my designs, usually it's things that I have come across that I just love working with and I love sharing. Whether it's beads or, you know, different threads, ways to combine them, whether it's containers or glass vials to keep your beads in, all of these things started with me coming across them and using them myself and then really enjoying doing this and offering it. The other thing that I've noticed is that I have come across so many fellow stitchers who say, I can't come up with colors, or I just am not able to do this. I need people to do it for me. And if you tell me what colors, I'll do the stitching, or, you know, along those lines. And I guess I believe that each one of us, if we've chosen to stitch, there is something inside us that is an artist. Otherwise, we would have maybe chosen to do puzzles or something. I think that we just need to encourage each other to bring that part out. And I find that putting together some color combinations of different threads gives people like an extra tool to say, I think I can go experiment with it. So, you know, I might give you 20 different threads and you can pull and know that somehow these are going to work together, but I'm not taking you the whole journey. I'm sort of opening a door, taking you up to a certain point, and hopefully giving you the courage to continue on your own.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
No, makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because that's the way I look at when you have those bundles, and you like on your blog you'll post something about some new bundles you put together, and that's exactly what goes through my mind is, all right, what could I do with this? And I just haven't pulled the trigger yet to do it, mainly because I have so many charts already kitted up that I really need to work my way through a few of them. But, exactly. I see that. Here's a color combination. What can you do with it? Yes.
I think it's getting over that hurdle. I'm sorry. Where do I start? You know, for somebody that isn't, familiar with it, you walk into a shop and it's every color and it's every texture, every type of thread. So you're giving them here's where you start. Mm-hmm. And once that part is done, then the rest of it feels easier.
Right. Yes. And really, I think that we can all do it. It's just either that we've been sort of suppressed over the years, or nobody has really encouraged us. But choosing something like knitting or stitching, I think it sort of says that there is a part of you that really is artistic. And so why not encourage it? I also make sure that the bundles always are packaged in a way where you can see them. So even if you're not using them, you can put them on a shelf and always look at them and kind of, you know, think or get inspired or just enjoy their beauty of being together.
I wonder when what that is. It's occurred to me before, because when you say you buy a chart, say buy one of your charts and the prescribed threads, this prescribed colors, and we all start that way, and some people always do that, where they always follow the prescribed colors because what they saw they liked. I wonder what's that fork in the road that leads somebody to say, wait a minute, this I like this design, but I want these colors. I want my own colors. And to, you know, because that's kind of a leap of faith for really anyone the first time to
yes.
go away from the safe paint by number approach,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to go off on their own and say, all right, I'll stitch this chart the way, you know, the various stitches and where they're located on the canvas. But I got this other set of colors in my head that I want to do. I wonder where that happens. And I was, as you were talking, I was trying to think back where that happened for me, and I couldn't pinpoint it, where I just felt comfortable enough that I could go off on that other path and try my own colors. I don't know.
I can tell you that many times people will say, I would like to change your colors. Do you mind? And my response is, not only do I not mind, I encourage to do that. First of all, for a very selfish reason, if I had the time to take a design and experiment in all sorts of different colors mm-hmm. and, you know, endlessly just play with that, that would be great. If you do that for me, that's fantastic. So, I know what it looks like when I do it in this or that combination. You have another one. Not only do I encourage, please send me a photo so I get to enjoy it too. And I think it's a great thing to do. You know, I teach a color class, and it's a really unique class. It's a 3 or 4 day class where I teach how to see color and how to interpret it into a needlepoint design. I'm probably not explaining it very well, but what the process of this class is that I start with a group of, let's say, 20 people who are sitting in front of me, and they all have this look on their mind, you know, on their face. I'm here, but I'm not sure what I'm doing here. Why did I get into this in the first place? And what do I know about color? And the process is that after 3 or 4 days, they leave feeling, oh my gosh, I can do it. I can do this on my own next time. And I think that that's just such a beautiful thing to see, that transformation. So getting to that moment that you talk about is, to me, a beautiful thing.
And as a teacher, that's got to be fun to see that unfold over 2 or 3 days as you teach that class. To see people's eyes, you know, the little lights go on all around the room.
It is the most fulfilling thing I can think of. It's absolutely a teacher's dream come true. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
you know, at the beginning of the class, I always wonder, is it going to happen this time too? Because there's no recipe, really. Is it going to work this time, or are they going to have that same face at the end of these 2 or 4 days? But it works, and I feel so thankful that I was able to watch them, you know, do that journey.
Yeah. Well, as a former teacher, I know that feeling. There's nothing like it. Nothing like it.
There isn't, is there? That's the beauty of teaching. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. All the other things just fall to the floor when you see that happen. And you've helped someone get to another spot. It's worth everything. Yep. No doubt.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. You know, as I was thinking about chatting with you guys this evening, and I was kind of putting some thoughts down, and one of the things that I was thinking about, I'm kind of taking over this interview, this chat. Okay. I don't mean to do
that. Feel free. That's why you're here.
But it sort of reminds me, because of what you're saying, that one of the things that I think in needlepoint, in the needlepoint world, we kind of get confused is whether we are artists, designers, technicians, teachers. And I think that there's sort of a demand that we be all of these things. Mm-hmm. So sort of if I were to compare, let's say that I paint and I'm an artist that paints, does that necessarily mean that I could teach painting? Or does that necessarily mean that I could teach what is the right way to use your brush or, you know, to mix colors? And I feel like that isn't necessarily something that we would expect from people in different aspects of craft and art. And yet, when we talk about needlepoint, a designer many times becomes a teacher and has to teach, you know, the right or wrong way to do a certain stitch. And I sometimes think that it's maybe too much. Maybe we should, you know, say, okay, I am a designer, but somebody else can be the teacher, and kind of split it up. I feel really lucky that I love teaching, but I know for sure that I'm not the best technician. If you want to learn how to do a certain stitch, I'm probably not the best person. I'm self-taught. So it's just an interesting kind of twist in that we have in the needlepoint. I don't know. Is it that way with knitting?
You know, honestly, as we're talking, I'm not thinking at all about knitting, and I'm thinking about my job. So in my other life, I'm a cosmetic chemist. And I'm thinking about the person who taught me how to do color in makeup. And in makeup, so you think about what goes into an eyeshadow. And this is going to sound like it's completely out there, but bear with me for a second. Just take a green eyeshadow, right? And you look at it. And when I was first learning, you'd look at it and you'd say, okay, it's green. And then part of your job is to match that green versus another green the next time it's made in a large quantity to see if it's made to standard, right? And so one of the things that I had to learn, and it's, again, it's just from experience being taught by somebody who's done it for many, many years, is looking at that green versus another green and saying, well, this green is actually blue and this green is actually has a lot of brown in it. And all of those things together, I think that's where the sort of the technology and the art comes in it. Because for us, right, so as a cosmetic chemist, you are an artist because you're blending colors. You're blending, if you had an eyeshadow palette, you're putting together five or six colors that look nice together but aren't necessarily in the same family. So it's the same in that regard. But you also have to know, in that green, is that green made up of, you know, green plus a little bit of brown and gold, or is it green with a blue undertone? And then being able to teach, you know, the next sort of round of chemists how to do that, it's exactly the same thing. You end up being all of those things. And then as a chemist, then you have to figure out how to blend all of those things technically. So that's where the stitching comes in. It's really, mm-hmm. how do you mix chemicals together to get the art at the end, to get the final product? And then the scaling is your instructions, is our writing instructions for a manufacturing plant to be able to make, you know, 17,000 of these, and do it perfectly every time. So there's a tremendous parallel there. I don't know that I have enough experience with designing knitting, and I think knitting ends up being different because a lot of it ends up being wearables. So it becomes less about art and more about function. But I think I'm guessing there. And I'm sure that there's a lot of wearables that are very much art and less about being functional. But as you're describing needlepoint, it truly is exactly like making makeup, really, because it's the same combination of teaching and technical and really appreciating color. And one of the things we joke about is that the person who taught me will walk into a room and say, this room is painted with two different cans of paint. And those two different cans of paint were mixed at the same time, but the person didn't mix the two cans together. And her eye is so good that she can see that, and she'll show me the line, and then you can't ever unsee that, right? So she says, be careful buying furniture, because unless you get them at the same place, you know, it's like dye lots, right? You can't unsee. Right. Once you have that sort of a fine-tuned eye, you can't ever unsee anything. So she's like, black is never black, and two blacks next to each other are never the same. And so I love her for what she has taught me, and I hate her because now I see those flaws all the time. You know, I look at something, oh God, you know, in fact, my dining room, I did exactly that. I painted with two different cans of the same exact paint, and didn't mix them together, and I look at it now, and it's not only the color of the paint, but it's one of them ended up a tiny bit glossier than the other, so I can see where the two. So now I have to completely repaint my entire dining room because it drives me crazy. And everybody else walks in and they're like, what are you talking about? And I'll turn the lights on really, really bright. And I'll say, see, it's not the same. And then they tell me I'm crazy. But I know if I have any of the chemists over, they'll go, Christine, how can you live here? So I think that there are their similarities.
Yeah. What an interesting profession you have. Wow.
It is very interesting. Yeah. And it is all about color and texture and aesthetic and blending that with technology and teaching. It really truly is exactly the same, just using different materials.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a huge parallel there.
Yeah, how interesting. Wow. Cool.
Yep.
Well, I'll need you to help me figure out eyeshadows. I'm very bad at that.
Very well. So we were going to do recommendations, Gary, you were saying?
Yes. We do need to wrap up. So a new thing as we evolve these podcasts, and this is not a new idea. I'm literally stealing this. And so I'll tell you the story about it. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and one of the podcasts I listen to is Abby Glassenberg. And Abby is, I think she's certainly a sewer, and I think she does a lot of quilting. But her podcast is the business of fabrics and quilting, and so she'll talk to people about building small businesses and people who built small businesses, like printed fabrics and those kinds of things. And it's a world you don't encounter unless you try. And so it's fun to listen to her, but she has the best podcast name ever dreamt up. And so it's called While She Naps. While She Naps. And when
that's,
I first,
that's excellent.
Yeah. And and of course I'm not a mother, so I didn't get it.
Yeah. Oh, I got it immediately.
Yes. I can tell you did. Yes. Yes. And it took me a few podcasts to go, oh, that's what she means. My time. My time. Yeah. So she does this wonderful thing. But then what she asks each of her guests to do is at the end to offer, sometimes it's four recommendations. So two or three things that they'll recommend. And in this case, it doesn't have to be stitching. It can be a book you've read or whatever. So we're going to try that. And Orna gets to be the guinea pig here with, with recommendations. And before we recorded, she said she was trying to narrow it down. And I said, nah, go for it. And then, Orna, you got to start with the one that I got to know. I can't take it anymore. So your first one, start with that one.
Well, my first one was, I recommend don't spend too much time prepping for dinner. Go to Trader Joe. Trader Joe's has the most amazing offerings. I just go there and fill my freezer with a bunch of good stuff, make some rice goes with everything, and there's dinner. So that's my first recommendation. Then you can stitch more, you can knit more, you can do all sorts of things with your time. And
I
then,
like that because now you've given me permission to do that, you know, and sometimes that's what it takes is somebody saying it's okay to kind of skimp out. So I'm going to take that recommendation.
I am giving you, I am giving you permission to do, if it matters, to do as much of the stuff you want to do as possible.
Yeah.
So go for it. Yeah, so that, and then the other thing that I was, that I do a lot of is I spend, first of all, I spend a lot of time online, which is sometimes not so good. But one of the things that I love looking at is, couture fashion. And I find that needlepoint, there's not a season where couture fashion does not use needlepoint in different ways. Right? And one year there were these amazing needlepointed boots, like knee-high boots, or it could be bags, or, you know, all sorts of things that make for great inspiration. And the other thing is also a lot of the period television shows give me a lot of inspiration. For instance, there is a lot that you can read about Game of Thrones and embroidery and needlepoint that's used in their costumes, which is phenomenal. So kind of looking at that and daring to take what we do further and, you know, really give it a lot of respect. I enjoy doing that and spend way too much time doing that. So that's my recommendation.
Okay. Trader Joe's and tons of time online.
And Game of Thrones. Yes.
And yes, Game of Thrones. Exactly. Exactly. Eat Trader Joe dinner while watching Game of Thrones. That's
there it.
There you go.
Right
in order
there.
To further your needlepoint. I'm so happy right now.
That's a bundle that can't be beat.
Yes, truly.
Yeah. All right, Arna, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much. I had a lot of fun. Thanks.
Yep. Well, thank you. And once again, find us on iTunes, where WeTalkFiber.com is the website. And Fiber Talk on iTunes. So subscribe and tell others. And thanks for listening.
Take care.